From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling announces charges against a Massachusetts state judge.
The law is not applied equally. It cannot credibly be applied to anyone.
Also today, new rules for ride-sharing companies are coming to Logan Airport.
I mean, if it was at, you know, 3, 375 and up to 5, that is quite a hike. It does seem a little bit high, considering if you're just being dropped off at the airport.
Plus, former Rhode Island Republican Congresswoman Claudine Schneider, a climate champion in 1988, on how the GOP became the party that opposes climate legislation.
I am an environmentalist before I am a Republican, so I'm going to advocate what's good for the health of the individual, the health of the planet, because they're inextricably intertwined.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We begin with news breaking this afternoon. U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling is charging a state judge and a court officer with obstruction of justice. They allegedly helped the man slip out the back door of a courthouse to avoid detention by U.S. immigration authorities. The judge, Shelley M. Richmond Joseph, has been suspended without pay, effective immediately, by the state's Supreme Judicial Court. Here's U.S. Attorney Lelling at a news conference this afternoon.
This case is not about immigration. It is about the rule of law. The allegations in today's indictment involve the intentional interference with federal officers in the course of their duties. That is a crime.
In a statement, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey calls the indictment a, quote, radical and politically motivated attack, and says she was, quote, deeply disappointed by U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling's misuse of prosecutorial resources and the chilling effect his actions will have, end quote. WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling was at U.S. Attorney Lelling's news conference this afternoon, and she joins us now from the federal courthouse in Boston. Shannon, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Callum.
Shannon, could you begin with just a little bit of the context here? Remind us what happened in this episode that these obstruction charges are based on.
Sure. So this all stems from a 2018 incident when an undocumented immigrant was in Newton District Court facing a drug possession charge. And also, it was believed he had a fugitive warrant out for his arrest from the state of Pennsylvania. So I say it was believed that he had a fugitive warrant out because here's where things get a little confusing. Immigration officials insisted that this was the same person that was wanted in Pennsylvania. The defense attorney and even the ADA in the case weren't as convinced that they had the right person, that the identity of the man who was there facing drug possession charges was also the same identity of the person who was wanted on a fugitive warrant out of Pennsylvania. So it gets a little confusing there. But essentially what happened is in a sidebar conversation, Judge Shelley Joseph is recorded commenting on these sort of questions about identity. And she's also recorded as having, you know, recognized that ICE was present at the courthouse and ready to take this man into custody. That they had a federal, what's called a ICE detainer, a warrant. And so basically what Lelling in this indictment is alleging is that what happened next was a pure effort to help this man dodge arrest by ICE that day. And by letting him essentially slip out a back door of the Newton court that day with the help of this other person who's named the court officer you mentioned, there were several counts of obstruction brought today. So it's a bit of a movie script type of narrative here, but that's the basic context.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, right? There's the possible case of mistaken identity. There's the presence of an ICE official at a state courthouse and whether that's appropriate. There's the possible obstruction. I mean, what did U.S. Attorney Lelling say about all of this today at this new conference?
Well, he made it really clear. I mean, we heard in one of those pieces of tape from the press conference, he did make it really clear that, you know, this is not about immigration, that this is about upholding the rule of law. He said that, you know, no one in this state is above the rule of law, even people who are powerful and in positions of power like judges. You know, he said, you know, this is we're doing this to show that the public can be confident in the fact that they'll get a fair shake at things. He made it really clear that this he wanted to it was clear from the get-go, Callum, that he wanted to separate the issue of immigration from the issue of what happened that day in the district court. And he said he's been hearing a lot of rumors running around in terms of people's opinions on his office's decision to dive into this investigation. Let's hear a little more from Lelling.
From certain quarters, I have heard the occasional gasp of dismay or outrage at the notion of holding a judge accountable for violating federal law. But if the law is not applied equally, it cannot credibly be applied to anyone.
So this is a big deal. It's not very often that a sitting judge is indicted on charges of this nature by a U.S. attorney, right? And I've heard from several advocates already that they are fearful, immigration advocates, that they are fearful that this will have more of a chilling effect, that people will be even more undocumented immigrants will be even more fearful of showing up to courthouses for scheduled court dates.
All right. WBUR's Shannon Dooling, stand by, if you will, at the federal courthouse. Thank you for that report. But I want to bring in also former federal judge Nancy Gertner, who is a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's senior legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So we had you and Shannon on this program some months ago when the Boston Globe first reported late last year that a grand jury was investigating Judge Joseph's actions. So what's your initial reaction today, hearing that U.S. Attorney Lelling is bringing charges in this case?
I think it's outrageous. The issue of what to do about ICE's presence in courthouses is a fraught issue as to which there was much discussion, which is how much to cooperate. The rules say cooperate, but how much to cooperate and when does cooperation essentially deprive illegal, undocumented people of access to the courts? If they know that they are obliged to be there, and if they're there, they're going to be snarfed up by ICE, then that affects access to justice throughout the courts. So this is a contested issue. And you have a judge who, no question, believed that she was not doing anything wrong. The standard for obstruction of justice, and I'm reading this from the Mueller report of all places, is that
how timely.
Right, that you have to willfully, with general knowledge of the illegality of your conduct, engage in this. The Mueller report was saying, hey, Donald Jr. didn't understand that what, you know, talking to the Russians was a problem. The notion that Judge Joseph, for a moment, thought that she was obstructing justice is preposterous. I think that what you have here, there were all sorts of ways that the U.S. attorney could have addressed this problem. There could have been an injunction. There could have been a civil proceeding. There could have been a discussion between the federal and state authorities. Judges are rule followers. If it had been clear that the line was drawn here that you shouldn't do this, there's no question it would have been over. To use the criminal process this way is like using a thermonuclear device to kill a gnat. I mean, it's outrageous, and the implications are even worse. Right?
But wouldn't U.S. Attorney Lelling, though, perhaps come back and say, well, you know, but maybe the bar, if anything, should be a little bit higher for a judge? She should know better. I mean, in other words, we might give the benefit of the doubt on an obstruction question to a private citizen like Donald Jr., but a judge should surely know.
Right, but you don't use the federal criminal indictment in order to keep a judge in line. If there was an issue here, there was an internal disciplinary proceeding to use against the judge. If she did anything wrong, and I'm not persuaded she did anything criminally wrong. But the implications of the federal government swooping in to indict a state court judge because of something that she did on the bench is really extraordinary. And to say that this is not about immigration is absurd. It is obviously about immigration, because if this was a mistake, at best it was a mistake, you never would have indicted for a mistake. And at best, that is all this was at a time. By the way, not only was the question of access to the courts up in the ICE's access to the court up in the air, but only months before this episode, the SJC ruled on the legality of a civil detainer, ICE civil detainer, holding that state officials could not arrest based on an ICE civil detainer. So at best, this was a confusing situation. And to swoop in like this and indict a sitting state judge, really, I can't even begin to tell you how outrageous that is and has implications. Judges now, state judges across the state now have to worry about the U.S. attorney coming to their door. Sanctuary churches now have to worry about that. Of course, this is about immigration. If it had been in any other setting, Lelling would not have bothered.
So implications for the judges. Shannon Dooling, let me ask you about implications for immigrants, because I'm wondering, and you sort of touched on this a moment ago, but I imagine some of the concern might be that immigrants might feel less inclined to be cooperative in legal proceedings if they're worried that there may be, you know, ICE sitting in the gallery waiting to pick them up.
I mean, that's exactly it, right? It's a question of, I mean, there are people I've been told by immigration attorneys, by immigrant advocates. There are some people that are afraid to show up for a hearing about a restraining order, or afraid to, you know, because they may not have documentation in the country and they're afraid that they'll be swept up at ICE, so they don't want to make charges. It has had a very I would say tangible chilling effect here in Massachusetts and across the country for certain. Two things to Nancy's points, though. I did ask the attorney, U.S. Attorney Lelling, about that Lund decision, Nancy, and said, you know, how did this SJC decision factor into your investigation, if at all? Did they? What was the interplay there? And he was rather dismissive, to be honest. He said, you know, two totally different you know, topics of conversation here. I don't really see how one is relevant for the other. And then the second question, to another point you made, Nancy, that I asked was, you know, how can this not be? He said this isn't about immigration. And yet he also said that Homeland Security Investigations, which is a branch of the Department of Homeland Security, led the investigation here. And so I found that to be sort of counterintuitive as well, and a bit puzzling that if this has nothing to do with immigration, why was HSI leading the investigation? And to that point, Lelling said that they really just wanted – his office wanted as many good investigators on this as they could get, and so they tapped them.
Go ahead, Nancy.
But here's a connection with the Lund decision. So the Lund decision says that state authorities cannot – be essentially deputized by the feds to arrest people on a civil ICE detainer. They can't be used in that way. And so the question becomes, in what way can the what's the relationship between federal-state cooperation in courthouses? And I think that that was an open question at the time that Judge Joseph did what she did. And we don't indict and criminally charge someone over open questions. So the two are related in the sense that you had to litigate the authority of the court officer to enforce an ICE detainer. And in addition, there were questions about what's the nature of cooperation between the state authorities and the feds in courthouses. It was an open question and a contested area, and this is not where you swoop in with criminal charges.
Let me ask you, Judge Kirtner, though, about one other point in the case, which is that we know that Judge Joseph shut off the courtroom recorder for roughly a minute. Not supposed to do that, but is this just a matter of, I mean, okay, you should get slapped with a parking ticket or the equivalent for that, but you shouldn't be indicted.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are so many steps between what she did and the criminal indictment. So there's a disciplinary proceeding. Gee, Judge Joseph, you did something wrong with respect to that. There are civil proceedings. I would, you know, to go into court to enjoin judges from not co-op, from doing these kinds of things in court. There's a memorandum of understanding between the state court and the federal court. There were so many steps. So to do this in the way that he has done it is a shot across the bow to every state judge in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Everyone should be outraged. You don't do things this way.
Shannon, it strikes me, though, that these shades of gray are part of what makes this case so interesting and so complicated, right? Because we do have a case where Judge Joseph shut off the recorder. And so there was something she did that was against protocol at a minimum. And then you mentioned earlier that the immigrant in this case was picked up on questionable pretenses because police ran his plate and thought that he was someone wanted for a drunk driving incident in another state. Turns out maybe he wasn't that person. And yet when they pulled him over, Shannon, police say they found drugs in the car. So it's a very fraught case, isn't it?
It is, like everything in immigration, in the world of immigration right. law. There are many, many different narratives, not narratives, many different avenues in terms of the legal ramifications for things when it comes to immigration law. And, you know, I think that what this case really reflects from the perspective of immigration proceedings, from the perspective of having covered immigration for the last few years, is that ICE agent was waiting at the courthouse. And that ICE agent – basically it comes back to the question of the presence of ICE agents in courthouses. And so, you know, when we talk about the Lund decision, which Nancy did a great job of recapping, which basically just says, you know, court officials or Massachusetts officials can't hold someone based solely on an ICE detainer. This defendant was free to go that day. So he was going to be let go. The court was not going to hold him any longer just so that ICE could detain him, which would have been a very blatant violation of even the most simplistic reading of Lund. But they knew, the judge, the defense attorney, and the ADA knew that an ICE agent was waiting to pick this person up. And they knew because the ICE agent identified themselves. And so I think that this really goes back to this question of how is justice served best to all of the Commonwealth's residents when people who are fearful of running into a scenario like this are not going to show up to court for criminal charges or right. civil charges for that matter.
The other thing, Shannon, is that this judge had a good faith belief that the authorities had the wrong person. The prosecutor
exactly.
agreed with that. And if she had a good faith belief that if swept up into the ICE system, it would take months, if not years, for him to disentangle himself. You don't put good faith and criminal charges in the same sentence. I mean, even if she did something wrong, this was the moment that Andrew Lilling ought to have declined to go to thermonuclear war. I mean, because of its implications for state-federal relations, ICE, all of that. Now, this is really outrageous.
Could she have handled it a little bit differently, though, Judge Kirtner? I understand that you've had some experience with
yes.
a possible case of mistaken identity in your courtroom.
Yes.
How did you handle it?
Well, I mean, what I did, and I suppose she could have done this, is that I was about to release someone when the government said that the person couldn't be released. We had to wait for ICE to come because he wasn't an American citizen. The defendant kept on saying, I am an American citizen. I am an American citizen. The government said, the computer shows you're not. I basically, maybe this was illegal, Mr. Lilling. I basically told everyone that they couldn't leave the courthouse at all, the U.S. attorney, until this was clarified, precisely because of the sense that ICE detention was a black hole and that it had to be clarified before he went into it. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, as it turns out, the man was an American citizen. The federal authorities had seized his passport, and the computer was wrong.
Wow.
So, you know, this is not an illegitimate concern. Even if improperly done, it was certainly a good faith concern that she had, and certainly not the subject of criminal charges.
I think worth noting, too, that she'd only been on the bench, I think, for 6 months at
right.
the time, so perhaps didn't have the experience that you had
right.
to have the wherewithal to know exactly how to handle it. Shannon, in the moments that we have left, what are we looking for next? I mean, is this thing actually going to go to trial?
Well, we should know more later this afternoon at around 4:15, both Joseph and McGregor are scheduled to make initial appearances here in Boston Federal Court. So be on the lookout for Twitter, and we'll have some more news on this tomorrow morning. So we'll see.
All right. We'll be following you at Shannon Dooling, WBUR immigration reporter. Thanks for your time, as always.
Thank you.
And Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's senior legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
State Senator Eric Lesser was in our studio today to talk about his role as a consultant on HBO's Veep. As fans know, Veep is in its final season, and Senator Lesser has been an advisor to the show since its inception. We'll hear that conversation tomorrow. But Senator Lesser also represents the 1st Hampton and Hampshire District in western Massachusetts. And while he was here, we also spoke about, you know, real news issues affecting his constituents, starting with the importance of arts and culture to the economy.
So we have amazing cultural institutions in Western Mass, and it's a huge part of our economy. In fact, it's the third largest sector of our economy by employment. And we have a lot of great community organizations in Springfield. So, for example, Community Music School is providing thousands of Springfield Public School students with music and art education programs. We've got also great institutions there. Dr. Seuss Museum opened a few years ago. The Springfield Symphony is expanding its programming. We're trying to get all of this coordinated and, frankly, marketed to Boston, because we'd love people in Boston to take that drive down the Mass Pike, hopefully one day a train, come check us out in Springfield.
A couple of news items while I have you, Senator. There's a survey out this week from the MassInc polling group on congestion in our state. It shows that roughly a fifth of residents have considered changing jobs because of their congestion, or even leaving the region altogether because of the congestion. I understand you talked about this too with the Springfield Chamber of Commerce. What's your message?
Yeah, this is a huge issue. You know, one thing I think we need to think about is that the solution will actually help the state. One project I've been working on for many years is to try to bring rail service to Springfield. You know, Western Mass actually has an inverse challenge to what the Boston area has. In Boston, you've got gridlock traffic and skyrocketing housing prices as a result. In Western Mass, we have a little bit of a different challenge, which is we've got a lot of great open space. The cost of housing compared to the Boston market is very affordable. We're not creating those high-paying jobs, that red-hot economy, though, to keep and attract new workers. So rail, for example, connecting Springfield and Boston would lift both ends of the state. It would give Western Mass access to those high-paying jobs. It would give the Boston area access to more affordable housing and hopefully a really high quality of life.
So move to Springfield and have a shorter commute.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Other news item I wanted to ask you about is this morning our own WBUR's Christine Wilmson reported on records from a January lawsuit that was filed by Attorney General Maura Healey against Purdue Pharma. This has been a very high-profile case. And today's reporting shows how Purdue allegedly manipulated legislation at the State House. Lobbyists who received money from the opioid maker gave money to politicians hundreds of times. In fact, since 2002, people associated with Purdue gave legislators, political groups, and causes at least $410,000. Senator, I know that you yourself received $850 from Charles Stefanini and his wife. Yep. He was a lobbyist for Purdue and other organizations. Stefanini told our station that to suggest campaign donations are related to one specific entity is just patently false. But I wonder what you make of it and what should voters make of it?
You know, so Charlie in particular, I mean, I agree with that quote. You know, I work with him, actually. I didn't even know that he had worked for Purdue. Actually, speaking of tourism, he represents the Springfield Regional Tourism Council, which is a big priority for me, and I'm certainly a big booster. But the bigger point is a very important one, which is we have a structural system right now that is not doing enough fast enough on the opioid crisis. And this is something I feel personally in my district all the time. I regularly am meeting with parents who have lost children, which is why, for example, during the budget debates last year and the debate we had on a new opioid bill, a provision I filed is actually looking at things like retroactive accountability for opioid executives, which, let me tell you, the pharmaceutical industry and Purdue is not happy with me about. So I've been very aggressive on the opioid crisis. I was the sponsor in 2015 of a budget item to allow for bulk purchasing of Narcan. We've also done quite a lot to try to expand our bed capacity in Western Mass for treatment services. And we've worked very closely with Maura Healey's office. And I think she should be applauded for this lawsuit because it's exposing, I think, the extent of the operation here and just really how systemic this was in Massachusetts, but actually across the country.
But just on the influence of lobbyists and, yeah. and their donations, I mean, whether the cause is tourism or drugs,
yeah.
I mean, you know, when they're giving money to your campaigns, does that have some effect, whether it's buying influence or just gets them in the door for a meeting? Does it make any difference?
For me, it doesn't. You know, I can't speak for everyone. You know, we've got a big group of supporters, and I kind of take people at their word when they're supporting me, you know, why they are. And I disagree with people all the time, and I'm very upfront about that. But absolutely, is there a challenge with money in politics? You know, we need to think about campaign finance. I think in Massachusetts, we're actually lucky that the donation limits are very low, relatively speaking, for lobbyists. It's capped at $200 per year. And actually, the individual donation that any individual person can give is capped at $1,000 per year. I think that that's important. There are a lot of states, for example, that have no cap at all, which is kind of scary when you think about the implications of that. So, you know, there's a lot we need to do. I've been a supporter my whole career, for example, of public financing and thinking about, you know, creative ways that we can support public financing of elections. So part of the other issue with the opioid crisis was it was more than even just the legislature. There was clearly a coordinated effort to market at doctors, to market at healthcare companies, to underwrite research. So the whole system really needs to be examined very aggressively, and this really needs to be a clarion wake-up call for what has to change. And I can tell you, because I meet all the time with parents who have lost children, this is destroying our communities, and the impact has been, you know, very devastating.
That's State Senator Eric Lesser. He represents the 1st Hampden and Hampshire District in western Massachusetts. His office sent us more information about his work on the opioid crisis. We have that at radioboston.org. And tomorrow we'll have the conversation with Senator Lesser about his role as a political consultant on HBO's Veep. Stay with us. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft will no longer be able to make curbside pickups and drop-offs at Logan's terminals. Instead, they'll have to find, or leave, riders at the airport's central garage. Also, there will be an additional fee of $3.25 for people getting dropped off by a ride-sharing service at the airport. Those are among the new rules approved earlier today by the Massport Board. WBUR's Quincy Walters was at that meeting and joins us now in studio. Quincy, thanks for coming in.
No problem, Callum.
So I sketched out a few of the particulars there, but could you fill in a little bit more details and explain why Massport is making these changes?
Right. So the goal is to reduce the traffic congestion that happens going into and out of Logan. In the months leading up to this, the reduction of CO2 emissions was sort of an equal goal, but at today's vote, the word environment was only mentioned once, and there was no mention of environment or CO2 emissions in the press release. But back to that reduced congestion, Massport is adding that $3.25 fee for ride-hailing services in the hopes that people will take other forms of transportation. There's also a slight discount if you share your ride, and there's also going to be a central area to be picked up and dropped off. Now you can get dropped off curbside, but that will change when the plan is expected to go into effect this fall. Curbside drop-off will only be offered between the hours of 4 a.m. and 10 a.m.
Huh. Interesting. I wonder whether 325 will really change behavior. The thing I'm wondering too, though, Quincy, is that, you know, the context here is that just this week we had a report from the Massing Polling Group about our frustration, our collective frustration with congestion in this area. They found that 30% of Massachusetts residents who have commutes longer than 45 minutes, so basically everybody, right, have considered leaving the area altogether because they're so fed up with the state's transportation system. So I guess what I'm wondering is if this proposal could address those frustrations in East Boston, where the airport is, but what kind of pushback is Massport getting for the plan?
Yeah, so it's come from different groups, but much pushback has come from advocates for disability rights. So Bill Henning, director of the Boston Center for Independent Living, had some thoughts.
There are various challenges if you don't have curbside drop-off. You know, somebody who's blind might not be oriented on where to go to the terminal. People with respiratory disabilities, mobility disabilities of other kinds might have challenges getting to the gates for their flights.
And Massport reps have said that they will work with the disability community to figure out accommodations. Today, they say they want this to have a minimal impact for people with disabilities. And some people also challenge the fee. So Heather Stagner, who was visiting Boston on business earlier this week, said she wasn't happy about the increased fare hikes.
I mean, if it was at, you know, $3.375 and up to $5, that is quite a hike. It does seem a little bit high, considering if you're just being dropped off at the airport.
And, of course, Uber and Lyft aren't too happy about this either.
I can imagine.
Earlier this week, Uber spokesman Harry Hartfield said in a statement that while the company wants to work with Massport, it considers this plan, quote, unfair, and that it will force rideshare customers to pay more and get less.
I imagine the unfair would have something to do with making the comparison between ride-hailing services and taxis, right? So what is the comp there, Quincy? Are taxis exempt from this?
Right. So, Callum, at the moment, no effect for taxis. The folks at Massport say that the volume of taxis in and out of Logan is significantly less than ride-hailing trips. I asked if there's been any lobbying from taxi drivers, and the answer was no, and that there's been no talks with them.
Interesting. Well, you know, it was interesting to hear from that that rider, Heather Stagner, talking about, you know, maybe even a $5 fee being too high, or the $3.25 where they ended up. But, you know, other cities do charge more, Quincy. I mean, in Seattle, there's a $6 fee for ride-sharing services. It's double that, $12 in Orlando. And they've still experienced some success. So I guess how much of this boils down to the way major cities are trying to deal with the ride-sharing services and what their impact is on the broader transportation picture in those cities as well.
Yeah, so first off, Massport is contending that their proposed hike, which will probably go into effect later this year, is significantly less than other cities comparatively. But ultimately, Massport is hoping that this is going to change the transportation ecosystem in Boston, where people use more public transportation and less private vehicles. And they're expecting this price hike to tilt the scale toward that. Lizzie Wyant with the Metropolitan Area Planning Council says this price increase will definitely change behavior.
So if we price people accordingly, they will actually change the way that they come in. And I think that the reason that this proposal is so important is because you couple that pricing structure with an opportunity for people to use a different mode of transportation.
And Wyant says at the same time, there will have to be improvements to Logan Express, which is the airport's bus shuttle, and Massport says it intends to do that.
Right. I would think so, right, Quincy? Because if you really want to change people's behavior, you're an extra few bucks in the scheme of a trip where you're spending probably hundreds of dollars on the plane ticket and then whatever
right.
else for the hotel and the rental car when you get to where. I mean, it strikes me that maybe a few bucks isn't going to be enough to swing people's behavior unless you improve the public transit options
right,
as well,
exactly.
right?
You have to give people an option.
So when are we going to see the effects of this? I mean, what's the timeline? Is this going in tomorrow or do we have a little bit of a wait time?
No. So that remains to be seen. So the plan is expected to start taking place in October. The board wants to meet every 6 months to get a continuous update on how all of this plays out. And Stephanie Pollack, who's the head of the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, says their desired goal of reducing congestion won't happen overnight, but that there's a willingness to see the plan through and change it as necessary to make getting to and from the airport a less gridlocked experience.
Okay. Well, I guess you can pencil that an assignment for yourself in 6 months' time.
Right. I'll see you then.
We'll talk to you then. That's WBUR's reporter Quincy Walters. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Callum.
And stay with us. Coming up, how the GOP became the party that opposes climate legislation. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Let's hear now a bit of congressional testimony about one of the pressing issues of our time.
Despite the continuing uncertainties about the specific regional impacts of a global warming trend, there is a very high risk of irreversible and catastrophic impact looming on the horizon.
There's a message that sounds like it could have been delivered on Capitol Hill today, but it's actually from 1988 and Rhode Island's then Congresswoman Claudine Schneider. Here's a little more.
We have the facts. We have the policies that are appropriate to reducing global warming. And I think that we have had far too much rhetoric on the part of our federal agencies, on the part of Congress. As far as I'm concerned, the crisis is here. The time to move from rhetoric into action is also here. And I am hopeful that my colleagues will move with me into action instead of sitting on our hands and waiting for the situation to get even hotter.
Oh, and I should also mention, Congresswoman Schneider was a Republican. So as Democrats push for a Green New Deal, how did the GOP become the party of climate change skepticism and, in some cases, outright denial? Let's ask Congresswoman Claudine Schneider herself. She served in the House as Rhode Island's first female member of Congress from 1981 until 1991, and she joins us now from Boulder, Colorado. Congresswoman Schneider, welcome to Radio Boston.
So happy to be with you, Callum. I appreciate your invitation.
Well, we're so happy to have you. And I'm wondering from where we stand today, you know, we've got the U.S. leaving the Paris Climate Accord, a lot of Republican pushback against this Green New Deal, some within the Democratic Party, too, I should say. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you could bring us back to what the climate conversation was like in the 1980s when you were in Congress.
In the 1980s, on the Science, Research, and Technology Committee, there was bipartisan understanding that climate was a real challenge. And actually, I felt that here I am in a position of power, and I have a moral obligation to act in the best interest of all the people. And many of my colleagues of both parties took that sentiment to heart. And so I introduced the Global Warming Prevention Act, which was an omnibus bill, which would partially educate members of Congress and also the general public about there's no silver bullet. Each of us have a responsibility to be part of the solution. And needless to say, parts of the bill passed. Those of you who go to buy a refrigerator or a washing machine and you figure out what the operating costs are by looking at the Energy Star rating, that was all part of our energy efficiency legislation. So when I told the appliance manufacturers that they had the capability to be more energy efficient, their first reaction was, no, it's going to cost too much. But then I said, too bad. I know that technologically you can do this because our national labs have indicated that it's possible, so let's do it. So in the end, they agreed to support my legislation. Today, however, the Republican Party has not only not held hearings in the Science Committee, I shouldn't say today, I should say before the midterm. So thank heavens, the old guard of the Republican Party in the House, many of whom have lost their seats, but now at least we're holding hearings in the Science and Technology Committee. But you asked the question, why has the Republican Party shifted?
Yeah.
I have one answer for you. Money. They have been bought off by the fossil fuel industry. And if it's a congressman from Virginia or Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, where they have the coal or some of the oil and fracking interest, there's a very clear correlation. There's a reason there's the phrase, follow the money. Because if you do, you will see that the voting correlates with those major contributors to the Republican Party. And most of them happen to be in the fossil fuel regions of our country.
Well, as we're talking about this shift of your party over time, I'm hoping that you'll journey with me down the timeline of that with the help of a little bit of archival tape. So walk with me here, Congresswoman Schneider. Let's go back to 2008. We've got the Republican nominee that year, John McCain, putting out this political ad touting his record on climate change.
John McCain stood up to the president and sounded the alarm on global warming 5 years ago. Today, he has a realistic plan that will curb greenhouse gas emissions.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
All right, fast forward 4 years. In 2012, the GOP nominee is former Massachusetts governor and now the Utah Senator Mitt Romney. He says this.
My view is that we don't know what's causing climate change on this planet. And the idea of spending trillions and trillions of dollars to try and reduce CO2 emissions is not the right course for us.
And then fast forward one more time to the last election cycle. Here's then-candidate, now President Donald Trump, at a South Carolina rally in 2015.
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and that. A lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax. A lot of it.
All right, Congresswoman Schneider. So how about that? That's not that long a period of time, right? But we've got John McCain not just being asked about it at a debate or something, but sort of voluntarily talking about climate change. You have Mitt Romney being maybe a little bit skeptical, and then Donald Trump, it's a hoax. What's going on there?
Well, John McCain did his homework. Mitt Romney obviously did not. And I can't even speak to the incumbent president because I think at this point, all citizens know that he says whatever he finds expedient for his own personal advantage. And the reality is the cost of inaction on climate change are just daunting. I mean, between 1980 and 2018, we're talking about 238 climate-related disasters totaling $1.5 trillion. So don't tell me that the remedies are going to be more expensive than that. And that's not even discussing the loss of life that has occurred. So when you look at risk, and Republicans are ignoring all risks, but at least the Department of Defense has not, they are spending substantial amounts of money so that they will be prepared. And they look at climate change as a national security concern. Not too long ago, the Federal Reserve also came out and they said that the banks need to do climate stress tests because many of the loan losses that are occurring at the banks are coming from bankruptcies, from wildfires, from drought storms, extreme weather, et cetera, et cetera. And agricultural losses, commodity price spikes, that sort of thing. So the messengers are substantial. We should not be listening to Republican politicians at this point, except Governor Weld, who is running against President Trump in a primary, has indicated that he is supportive of action on climate change. But the bottom line is, whether it's the American Medical Association, who came out in support of action back in 2016, or whether it's the Defense Department or the economists who have also made it real clear we need to move ASAP, there's urgency here. There was urgency 30 years ago, but now we're realizing the impact of our inactions.
We're talking about climate change and the GOP with former Rhode Island Congresswoman Claudine Schneider, herself served as a Republican. And I'm wondering, Congresswoman, if you see any other bright spots within your party on climate change. You mentioned Bill Weld, who is challenging President Trump. I'm also thinking of Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. He's not seeking re-election, but he is offering something that he calls a New Manhattan Project for Clean Energy, which is a 5-year plan to reduce carbon emissions and create cleaner energy sources. I mean, is it also bleak in the GOP?
Pretty much so. I mean, Governor Hogan, who is from Maryland, is also positive on climate. And I think it is very bleak within the Republican Party. The president chose to say that this is a hoax, and his enablers have followed, including the Republican National Committee. So the leadership there is minuscule by comparison. But I think that the other detriment that is currently going on in the political environment is the divisiveness. And so just for a bit, Callum, let's not look at the parties. Let's look in the mirror and say, what can I do about climate change? Because if we sit on our hands and wait for the Congress to move some grandiose legislation, we're wasting time. And there are many things that the listeners right now can do, whether they are CEOs of corporations or employees or homemakers. They can all be part of the solution.
Well, on that point, though, I'm curious what kind of guidance you have for individuals, because we've done some reporting here at WBUR, and I've seen elsewhere, too, about changes to recycling standards in a lot of municipalities, you know, and how China, for example, has raised the standard of recyclable equipment that it will buy. And so some cities have had to sort of walk away from their recycling projects for now. That's got to be discouraging for people who want to feel like they're contributing by sorting out their recyclables in the trash every day.
Well, that's the bad news. I'm the good news girl here.
And all right, then let's hear it.
Reality is,
what's the good side?
There is some talk now in a number of different municipalities where they want to receive those recyclable materials and turn them into new products. I mean, you may have heard the phrase cradle to cradle, as opposed to taking a product and then throwing it away. Instead, reusing it and repurposing it and taking the materials and building new products. And there's much of that going on, but on a very low level. The clothing industry is very much now becoming more focused on the circular economy, where, in fact, large retailers like H&M will encourage you to bring a bag of clothing in, whether you bought it at their store or not. They will give you a 15% discount on your next purchase, and they take those materials, recycle them, and if they are clothes that are in good shape, they will be repaired and given to the less fortunate, or they will be shredded and made into new materials and into new clothing. So more of that is starting to take place across the country. So I think that's a plus. But let me send some kudos out to Raytheon right there in your backyard.
Sure.
And also
Staples. Big defense
Staples.
Contractor.
Yeah.
And Staples, yep, big hometown company.
Years ago, EPA wanted corporations to voluntarily agree to reduce their 6 greenhouse gases, just not carbon. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to be a part of this. So I was just basically on the phone, round the clock, dialing up corporations, asking them what they're doing with their greenhouse gases. And I put together my own little strategic plan, geographic, also in terms of who are the largest contributors to greenhouse gases, like the cement and steel industries, and I targeted those. And in the end, recruited about 50 corporations who made that commitment to EPA to reduce their greenhouse gases. Well, I would love for you, Callum, to have an interview with someone from Raytheon and Staples and tell the community how much money they've saved as a result of taking those actions, because the corporate world is saving billions upon billions of dollars by reducing their greenhouse gases, in other words, using less energy. I will also say that in the past, I had been an advisor to National Grid because they were interested in looking toward the future, planning on what they should be doing on climate, and I assisted them in that respect. They asked these questions of me at a time when most utilities were digging in their heels and refusing to do anything. So, you know, there is hope from some of the largest contributors to greenhouse gases. But I want to follow up on the individuals. One of the most, and it does tie back into your question that's political, one of the most important things that people can do is to vote with knowledge. And if you're too busy to track your elected officials, which I constantly hear, you can learn the sources of their campaign contributions and follow the money. In addition to that, you can find out how they're ranked by various professional organizations, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce or the labor unions or environmental groups or women's groups. Go to votesmart.org, and it will give you that information, very brief, to the point. It could take you less than 10 minutes to figure out who you want to vote for just by looking at that information. Secondly, everybody can just stop using fossil fuels. figure it out. If you put enough LEDs in your home and business, if you insulate, then certainly you're moving along on the right path. And also, there are groups in Washington, D.C. right now that are working round the clock to stop the dismantling of the Environmental Protection Agency and to make sure that our clean air and clean water laws are enforced. My favorite is the environmentalintegrity.org organization. So you can most certainly make contributions to those that are on the front lines. You can also take your money out of fossil fuels. I was serving on an environmental board, and I one day asked at the board meeting, where are reserves invested? Well, they said, well, with the bank. And I said, no, in what corporate entities? Well, they weren't certain. Well, from that moment on, I started focusing on divestinvest.org, which is where you can go in order to make sure that your retirement funds are not invested in fossil fuels.
So just jam-packed full of advice there, Claudine Schneider. And just in the brief moments that I have you left, I did want to squeeze this in because a lot of these, we've talked about the Green New Deal, and a lot of female politicians are really out in front on that. And I mentioned you were the first woman to serve in Congress from Rhode Island. We've got 131 women in this latest Congress. So just in the final moments, is this finally the much prophesied year of the woman in politics?
Well, I certainly hope so, because women have a tendency to think more frequently about the future. And all of us, including the women policymakers and the male policymakers, and we as citizens need to think, what kind of world are we leaving our children when it comes to climate change and our grandchildren? So hopefully everybody will roll up their sleeves and get to work.
That's Congresswoman Claudine Schneider, who served as Rhode Island's first female member of Congress from 1981 to 1991. Congresswoman Schneider, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.